This is Keep It Juicy, episode 38.
Hello, and welcome to Keep It Juicy, a weekly podcast that features experts on living a juicy life. What's a juicy life? It's a lifestyle for those who have put in a few miles and are ready to turn off-road, who are still learning and excited, who are fearless, or who are scared but dare anyway. Juicies are grown-ups, so some of our language may not be appropriate for children. Juicies are bold, passionate, and ready to squeeze every drop of juice out of life. I'm your host, Helen Mitternight. Are you ready? Let's keep it juicy.
I'm your host, Helen Mitternight. I have lots of friends who are writers or who want to be writers. We wonder what magic dust has been sprinkled over the successful writers, and we want to know the clues. Today, I'm talking with best-selling author Beverly D'Onofrio about that magic dust. And guess what? It's not magic. It's hard work and rewriting and then even more rewriting. Beverly has written lots of books, but she first burst onto the scene with Riding in Cars with Boys, which became a movie starring Drew Barrymore. Since then, she's written memoirs, children's fiction, and she's written essays in the New York Times, LA Times, Oprah Magazine, and Slate. Living a juicy writing life today on Keep It Juicy. Beverly, welcome to Keep It Juicy. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me, Helen.
I, for the listeners, met Beverly at a writer's retreat on Asabaw Island, which is this isolated island. And
with wild donkeys and little pigs.
And lots of gnats.
And lots of gnats.
Yes. And it's wonderful because you get to, you know, I had heard of Beverly before because, of course, I'd heard of her book and I had seen, for those of you who maybe haven't, Beverly is the author of Riding in Cars with Boys and lots of other things. But I had read that and then I saw the movie that Drew Barrymore was in. So I had, of course, heard of Beverly. But the good thing about being on this isolated island, besides the fact that, you know, you really get some concentrated time, is you really get to hear people's writing and meet them. And I was so taken with you, Beverly, that I really wanted to have you on this podcast. So thank you.
Well, and I was taken with you too. I love Asabaw. I love the relationships that develop in the, and hearing that last night when you hear what everyone's been working on. And I'm always or often really just floored when I'm at these workshops and the students present, because so often I think I can't tell the difference between what you read and what the teachers read.
Oh, that's lovely. Yeah. Well, from your lips to some agent's ear. So you, when you wrote the book that got turned into the movie, how much of yourself did you put into it?
Well,
I know now you teach memoirs, right?
It was a memoir. I mean, it began, I was in graduate school way back in 1980 at Columbia, and there were few MFA programs back then. And it was called the MFA in Creative Writing. And I was writing a novel and I wrote the first draft of Riding Cars with Boys, but I thought it was a novel and it wasn't really a draft. We had to complete 150 pages. And I did to the best of my ability, still not really knowing what this was about. It would take me 9 years after that to finish the book. And it got failed by Judith Rossner, who was my reader, who I didn't know. I had taken an extra semester to finish it. And I'd chosen her because I thought that she wasn't a literary writer and neither was I. She was the woman who wrote Waiting for Mr. Goodbar. Do you remember that?
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Yeah. And so she read it and I have the first sentence, this run-on sentence memorized. And it goes something like this. It's easy to see why Beverly D'Onofrio's energy has been mistaken for talent. While her characters neither act, behave, speak, have sex like normal human beings, but like cardboard cutout characters from a situation comedy going from one implausible situation to the next. And it was devastating.
Ouch.
Right. And luckily if you got failed by your reader, it went to the head of the program, who then had the last word, and he passed me. And I was in therapy at the time. My therapist said, "This is personal. That's not, I mean, a teacher doesn't flunk someone like that. This is, you have to speak to her." And my self-esteem was so low, I couldn't even imagine doing that. And I quit writing and I got a job as a copy editor at a magazine. But come to find out years later, I met someone who was her friend from high school and had remained her friend all her life, Judith Rossner's. And at this point, Judith Rossner was dead. And she told me that Judith had gotten pregnant in high school herself, and her parents had made her give up the baby for adoption, while my parents, and the next line in the critique was one implausible situation to the next, parents encourage daughter to have child, which my parents had encouraged me to have it, and they would adopt it. So anyway, that was devastating. But I so diverged from your question. What was it?
No, that's okay. I this is fascinating. I can't believe that somebody would say that. And then how do you feel when she's telling you it's cardboard and implausible and this is your life?
I know. Well, you know, I was kind of used to it at that point, because I would submit things into workshop and inevitably during a semester, somebody would say, "Oh, this is just so cliche Italian." And it was like, but that's how my parents acted. That's how they spoke. You New York reading idiot, New Yorker reading idiots, you know, they just didn't have a clue.
So, okay. So that book was a while ago now.
Yes. A long time ago. Came out in 1990.
What would you do differently? I mean, that, you know, that's, now you can look back on it. I'm not talking about your life. I'm talking about the book.
I really like that book. I could not write that book now. I am 68 years old. I was in my early 30s up until I wrote it all through my 30s, finished when I was 38 years old, and was barely out of being an adolescent at that time. And it's infused with the perspective of an adolescent, the voice of an adolescent. And if I were to write that now, I would be imitating how I think I spoke back then, where when I was 35, I wasn't so different from the person who was 17 still. So it's very much an adolescent coming of age story.
Well, you teach memoir writing now, because that's what you were teaching when I met you at Asaba. Mm-hmm. What do you tell your students in terms of forgiving not only themselves and who they were, but also the people who populate the story? You know, in your case, your mom, your dad.
I tell them that the forgiveness comes in the writing, that in order to write well about yourself or anyone else in your life, you have to do it with compassion. And you reach that compassion by actually beginning by saying, "Oh, that sounds awfully bitter. How could I write that in a not bitter way?" And the writing, the crafting, and this is something that I believe with all my heart, that when you apply logic to emotional experience in writing, you're applying craft and you're moving it from the right emotional side of your brain to the left logical side of the brain. It functions a lot like EMDR therapy, you know, that rapid eye thing and that tapping, where you'll go to a therapist and he or she will have you look at a finger going really rapidly, and you go to the emotion and somehow it moves the emotion from the right emotional side to the left logical side, and you're no longer triggered by it. And that happens when you write well about your life. You often have resistance to the emotion, to going back, to reliving that scene, because it's too painful. And the writing really stinks because you're resisting it. But if you keep rewriting and going at it and trying, eventually you open to going back to the incident that you're writing about, and the writing flows, and then you have to make it into something someone else would want to read. And that then you start applying craft. Well, I should probably begin in the middle of the scene instead of the very beginning of it. And I'll have her stand up when she says that to emphasize whatever. You know, you start detaching from it by applying the craft, and it works. They use it in veterans writing group. They use writing groups for veterans who are suffering from PTSD now.
Oh, I had a guest who talked about trauma and journaling, mm-hmm. but it sounds like, and she was saying many of the same things, but it sounds like that craft, like when
I
you,
think it's key.
That's what makes the difference, because otherwise, you know, I don't want to read somebody's therapy.
No. It's just, you know, spilling words onto the page isn't what's going to do it. It's going making a story of it.
When you're teaching memoir writing, you know, everybody thinks, well, not me, because I had a pretty happy childhood, but everybody else seems to think that their life is just so unique and so interesting and so worthy of a memoir. What is it in your mind that makes a book, a memoir, successful? Is it the story of the life? Is it the craft? Is it the lessons that you get from the story of the life? Like, what is it?
It's the internal journey. It's the soul work that happens. It's, you know, there's that, like Vivian Gornick says, there's the situation and there's the story. So the situation is the event. For example, my third book was launched because I got raped in my own bed when I was 56 years old. That was the incident. That was the situation. But the story is then what I did with that, how I processed this, who I was before this happened, and who I became through the process of experiencing the aftermath, the PTSD, the reading of mystics, the going off to monasteries, the kind of, it's you can write a beautiful memoir about a day in an ordinary life. It just depends on the internal journey that takes place while you're living that ordinary life, or that gets triggered by that ordinary life, by a memory. Like, look at Mrs. Dalloway in Virginia Woolf. You know, it's the same thing. It's all the,
it's the minutiae of her daily life. I remember that story. And that's another one that got made into a movie with, I'm blanking on her name, redheaded actress. Wonderful. So it's the hero's journey, just like in literature, right. But it's applied to looking,
it happens
framing
in the
your life.
Of a mundane day, the quotidian, the miraculous in the quotidian, really.
Lovely word. What's the biggest mistake that you see the students that you teach? What's the biggest mistake they're making?
Well, you know, I teach in two different formats. One, I teach in an MFA program. So that's one thing. And then I teach also weekend long workshops or 5-day workshops at places like Omega and those that I organized myself at this monastery. And what I tell those people, this is not the MFA people, but a lot of people take workshops and they take it to stimulate the writing. And it's a wonderful way to do that. And there's great stuff that happens because you do that. Real gratification in sharing your stories, which maybe we don't get to do enough. I don't know. But then if you want to make something of this raw material that gets generated in this workshop, it requires rewriting and rewriting and rewriting and rewriting and crafting and rewriting. And the mistake a lot of people make is thinking that it has to come out when you first write it. Nothing, you know, maybe 0.01% of what I've written comes out great the first time I put it down.
How many for a a book, a memoir format book, how many revisions do you think you do?
Oh my God. Well, I revise. Okay. So I have novelist friends who say, just plow on through. You know, those people who say, you know, produce 1,000 words a day and just keep going forward until you reach the end of your first draft and don't have great expectations and you're just finding out what your story is. And then the next draft, you start making something of it. I cannot do that. I rewrite the first page. You know, I rewrite constantly. I cannot tolerate my own bad writing. So I keep going back and going back and going back and crafting and doing it better. And so when I'm happy with, say, a first chapter, I maybe have been working on it for 2 months, going back and back and forth and now a little bit forward and then back again and revising and going a little bit forward and back again and like that. So maybe the better way to answer this question is, usually if I get I have been graced with getting contracts to write the books I've written before I've written them. And I always ask for 2.5 years. And so it takes me 2.5 years of crafting and rewriting and drafting. But so, you know, that first one, okay, now I think I'm done with the first chapter. I'm going on to the second. And then I go on to, say, the 12th chapter, which is the last one. And I've written them to the best I can possibly get them. Then I sit down and I read that whole thing. And then I write it again. And then I might write it again before I show it to my trusted readers, my friends who are also writers or who are good readers. And I give it to them and get their notes. And then I go back and I rewrite it again. And maybe it'll be done then and maybe not. I find often the first draft is rough. The second full draft is you takes those notes and goes overboard with them. Just, you know, it's almost worse than the first draft. And then it all settles and the third draft is the key.
Wow, that's a lot.
That's a lot.
Now, I wanted to also go back and ask you, because you talked about writing with compassion, mm-hmm. as you're writing about other people and writing about your past life. How much do you key the people that you're writing about? How much do you clue them in that they're going to be in this book?
Okay, I just want to say a little bit more about compassion. You have to put yourself in everybody's shoes. So say I'm writing about, you know, announcing my pregnancy to my parents and my father, you know, had an overblown reaction. See what I told you she was doing in the basement. And I thought, and I had to say, okay, how did he feel when he heard his teenage daughter was pregnant? How would I feel if I were him? So it's not just compassion. Well, I guess it is compassion getting into
it's empathy too.
Shoes, right?
Yeah, it's empathy. Right.
I don't tell anybody I'm writing about him.
Well, that's fair. I mean, because I would imagine you could be paralyzed with worrying about somebody's reaction.
You can't go there. You just cannot go there. It will freeze you up so fast. So, for example, I am now writing about my life now, and I have grandchildren, and my son is almost 50 years old, and I've written about my poor son for every time, and I have more trepidation now than ever before about exposing things, especially about my grandkids. I have the ability not to think about them when I'm writing, but I'm reserving judgment on whether I'm going to use some of this stuff or not.
Well, was it Nora Ephron's mom always said everything's copy?
Exactly. It's all material. It's all material. Right. And it's a wonderful way to look at life. Like, I'm just reading this spiritual book, and it's an old tenet that, you know, it's a great spiritual path to live your life as though it's your last day, as though death is at the door. And it's equally a great life to look at your life as though it's all material, because then it becomes, you're looking at it with freshness, with what's interesting here, what's usable here, what is unique about my lawn right now in the rain.
I don't know. I mean, I have a lot of friends who are writers because of what I do. And I all of them seem to have like this internal narrator.
Yeah.
Always talk, like sort of just always narrating their life for them, which sounds probably very close to mental illness if you're not a writer.
Exactly right. Exactly right.
Yeah, you're always writing.
Always writing.
What's, you know, you said it takes 2.5 years for your books that you're contracted for the other writers who are listening.
But I have to say that too, in order to get that contract, I may have written for a year.
Ah.
So let's say 3.5 years to do a book.
Okay. Okay. All right. So what is your writing process? Everybody, you said you're not necessarily one who sits there and cranks out 1,000 words a day because you just can't do that. So what do you do? Is it morning, noon, night, like when you feel what are you doing?
Listen to me with a grain of salt. You have to really figure it out for yourself, dependent on your own rhythms, your own way of being in the world. So I'm a morning person. And so that's when I write. I have the best energy, the best interest, the best freshness then. So it's the first thing I do. But first I have to have my coffee and I do some tarot cards and I do yoga and some breath work and get really centered. But that's me because I'm a neurotic mess and I have to still my mind. So that's what I do. And then I sit down and I write. And I write for as long as I can go. And if it's first draft material, it's not very long at all. It could be an hour or two, or it could be longer. But I really love rewriting. So if I'm rewriting that raw material the next day, I could go much longer.
And is it every single day or you take weekends off?
Or? Well, I used to take Sundays off as a day of rest. And I don't know, I've been doing this for so long now that I can pick it up. So I try to do it every day. But if I skip a day, I don't freak out that it's going to be hard to get back to. I just get back to it. And also I can sometimes, if there's a class in the morning or I have a house guest and it's a beautiful day and we want to go walk up the mountain first thing in the morning when it's still cool, I can do that and come back and pick up the writing. But I couldn't have done that even maybe 10 years ago. It's a new thing. So
it's like writing muscle memory almost.
Yeah, exactly. Writing muscle memory. I really like that. Yep.
So what makes you decide to hop amongst genres? Because you did memoir and now you've got children's fiction. And what makes you decide?
No, I had a line came to me for the first kid's book. It just popped into my head after my grandson was born. It became the first line of the book. Mary lived in a big house with a little mouse. The mouse lived in the big house with Mary. And that just set my imagination reeling about these parallel lives being lived and they don't know each other. And then one day they encounter each other. And so, I wrote that like in one sitting and then revised and revised and revised. And then the next one was a sequel to that. So it seemed like the illustrator was fantastic and the editor invited me to do it. So it was like that. And then I wrote a middle grade novel and I always wanted to write about the year in fifth grade when my best friend dumped me for my arch enemy. And so why not write it as a kid's, a book for 10-year-olds? And so I did that. I don't know. I can't give you a formula for this.
Well, you're lucky that you're so good at all the genres, but you're also lucky you're able to convince people to buy all the genres because I know some writers who have been pigeonholed.
Oh my God. Yeah.
And they can't, even if they want to.
I know.
So that's wonderful.
It's really a terrible world out there. The last book I had, it was a memoir and I had finished it and I was invited out to dinner with my agent, the head of the Viking Penguin and my editor. And, we're in New York City at a restaurant and I go to the bathroom and I come back and I hear, I can't sell it. I can't sell. And they looked up at me and they said, "Oh, don't worry. We're talking about fiction."
Oh, Well, you've been doing this for a while. So what kinds of changes have you seen in the publishing industry?
Oh, my God. It's just, I don't have a clue. I don't have a, you know, the last book, it came out in 2012, I think. And they made me get on Facebook and Twitter. And I'm terrible at it. I don't want to do it. I do not do it. And this next book, I mean, I'm so aware that I better get my shit together and make myself have some sort of platform out there in social media, or they're not going to publish me. And, you know, that was just not those, that vocabulary didn't even exist when I began. One expected that the publisher did all the publicity and all the footwork. And, you know, now it's like, fill out a questionnaire. Who do you know who can help? And how are you going to promote your book, and who's going to buy it, and why should we buy it? And it's like all marketing. It's all capitalism. It's just the way the whole world is now.
Well, you get on there and send me your links, and I will have my listeners follow you on Twitter and Facebook, and then you'll have some people.
Right now there's a message on Facebook that says, I don't come here very often, so don't have your feelings hurt if you don't answer you.
But that's not building a platform. No. Now I'm pretty sure.
Oh God, I do have a website though. I have managed to do that and have a calendar that's fairly up to date about the workshops I'm doing and stuff. And I'll try to post this on my website so people can listen to it.
And I will post a link for people to the website, and they could look and they can buy books.
Yeah, and there's some essays on there that I've been good about reproducing from various publications.
Well, that sounds like a great place to leave it. So we'll just send people to your website.
Wonderful.
Thank you so much.
Thank you,
for
Helen.
Talking with me.
I hope I didn't talk too much.
No, are you kidding? This was wonderful. Thank you.
Bye-bye. You take care.
Bye. If you want to buy Beverly's books or even check out that writing retreat we talked about, check out the Juicy's resource pages on our website, keepitjuicy.com. Next week is a mini episode about fogs, the fear of getting stupid. And then we're back to the following week with a full episode talking to return guest Andrea Brandt about the purpose behind pain. You can keep up with us on Facebook and Twitter at keepitjuicy.com, or go to my website and sign up for the newsletter. And it really helps if you go on iTunes and leave a review. Meanwhile, go out there and keep it juicy.